But you can really see some of the impact on exports, again, by comparing the UK to other advanced economies. Financial services exports have been on a bit of a tear, at least in nominal terms, with the recovery from the pandemic. And so other countries' exports, on average, have been growing pretty rapidly, whereas the UK's have been much more stagnant. That stagnation set in around 2019, which is as it became entirely clear that the UK was going to leave the single market with the failure of the second referendum push, and the ascension of Boris Johnson.
Hello, I'm Brendan Donnelly, the former director of the Federal Trust, and today I shall be chairing a discussion between two Johns. John Springford has recently written a very interesting report for us, the Federal Trust, and for the Constitution Society, on the subject of the economic costs of Brexit. John Stevens, of course, is chair of the Federal Trust, and someone with much experience, probably more experience than he cares to remember, of the financial and economic history of the United Kingdom over the past 30 years. John, you are an associate fellow of the Centre for European Reform, but with this hat on, you've written a report for the two other organisations, Federal Trust and the Constitutional Society. And what you've done, and very interestingly done, is attempted to work out an economic cost for Brexit since 2016. You make the point in the beginning of the report that a number of estimates have been made over the past 10 years using different methodologies. You have a methodology, which I think is very much associated with you, the doppelganger methodology. Can you briefly describe to us what are the characteristics of that methodology, how it differs from other methodologies, why you favour it, and why and what conclusions you've come to as a result of the application of that methodology?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you very much for having me. The key thing, I think, when thinking about trying to assess the impact of any kind of quote unquote policy intervention, which Brexit certainly is, although it's also a constitutional change, hence the involvement of the Constitution Society, I guess, it is to think about different methods for trying to estimate impact. And one of the really difficult things is that we can't travel to a universe where Remain won. So we're having to rely on inference, essentially. And there are two kind of main ways of doing that. One is the kind of forecast, long-term forecasts, which the OBR has cited, and the OBR has taken the average of the long-term forecasts about what the impact of Brexit will be. And of course, they are from before the impacts have come through. They are what we call ex-ante models. And the idea behind them is that you get all sorts of different variables that make up economic performance. And then you shock one of them with some plausible assumptions that kind of try to mirror what Brexit might be like. So you have a hit to trade, and you estimate that based on some other methods, which we could talk about. And then
I'll just
you.
clarify something. Is this something that was done in 2016, or are you talking about things that are still
Yeah,
done?
so this is. This was a range of the range that the OBR takes as its kind of
Office
average.
for Budgetary Responsibility.
The Office of Budget Responsibility takes as its average is they're broadly between, I think, 2015 and 2019. So before the UK left the single market and customs union, which is when the real trade shock took place. And the models, they try and estimate what that trade shock would look like, and then see how that ripples through the rest of the economy and affects overall economic performance. And the OBR's average is of those outcomes is about 4%. So my way of doing it is kind of a complement to that, or just a different way of looking at it. And by comparing the two, then we can have some sort of sense about whether whether the OBR average is about right. And my method, it takes a kind of big panel of 23 other advanced economies, and they're the economies that the IMF designates as advanced from 1995. So we get rid of petrostates and other places which aren't really a very good kind of comparator to the UK. And then from that, an algorithm looks at the GDP performance of the UK between 2009 and 2016. And it tries to find the combination of those 23 countries whose GDP path is most similar to the UK's between 2009 and 2016. And then thereafter, we can use that kind of doppelganger as the first people who used this method on Brexit dubbed it. You can use that kind of group of countries as a kind of counterfactual UK that remained in the EU, and measure the distance between UK performance and that group of countries. And by the middle of 2022, i.e. before the energy crisis, and we can discuss that, but that kind of throws the model off for all sorts of reasons. But by the end of 2022, then we saw around a 5% gap between UK GDP and that group of countries, the doppelganger GDP. So the interesting thing is that that ends up being about the same as the OBR average. There's problems with both the kind of ex-ante models where you're trying to forecast what happened, and my backward-looking, quote-unquote, ex-post model, which we can discuss. But that's basically how my method compares to the methods that the OBR has been using for its estimate.
John, the other John.
Well, I was really wanting to start by asking you whether you regard the hit of Brexit as being essentially a one-off that will fade with time, or whether it has a cumulative quality that will, in some respects, not just continue, but perhaps get worse over time. Because that seems to be very central to current debates.
Yeah, I think that's right, and that's the exact question that we find very difficult to answer. So the usual way, or the way that most models have done this, in terms of the OBR's modelling of the future, the different models that underlie that, most of them see it mostly as a one-off. So you have a kind of path of GDP, and then a period of stagnation. And then GDP returns to its original growth path, or a growth path that is not affected by Brexit. But there are models, the London School of Economics and UK and a Changing Europe offered one of these, which tries to model where if Brexit changed the growth rate, like pushed it downwards, in which case you would have larger and accumulating costs over time. And there are some reasons to believe that that kind of assumption is a good one, because there are all sorts of ways in which being open to trade, migration, and investment can raise growth rates. So you've got a lot more competition from imports, and that constant thrust of competition against your own companies means that they have to invest more, they have to innovate more, they have to try and improve their production processes. And that pressure can improve growth. And if you re reduce that pressure, which you do by imposing lots of trade barriers on yourself, as we did with Brexit, then the growth rate might diminish slightly. And there are other routes that that kind of process can happen, i.e. through immigration. So if you are bringing in skilled workers who have know-how, or who allow workers in your own economy to kind of specialize on tasks, then that can also improve growth rates. So there's good reason to believe that trade barriers or trade opening do change growth rates. But we find it very difficult to model, and we don't really have a good way of knowing or assuming what the overall magnitudes of those effects might be. So a lot of people who are doing these kind of long-run conditional forecasts about Brexit tend to say, okay, well, that might happen, but we're going to leave it outside the model because it's quite difficult to do. But if you do that, then you end up with much bigger impacts. I mean, the LSE and UK and Exchange in Europe ended up with about 9% I think overall hit to Brexit over the long run, when they included some of these bigger productivity growth impacts.
But where is your own view on this? I mean, do you think that these concerns about longer-term impact are justified, or do you think they're overblown, or?
My suspicion is that there's going to have to be some impact. The weight of evidence about the importance of openness to foreign direct investments, bringing in new capital to immigration, bringing in new skills to competitive pressure is fairly robust. So I would expect there to be some impact. I have to be honest, I have absolutely no idea how big that impact would be. And I don't think reading a lot of the work where people have tried to model that kind of impact, that they would be very confident either. And they say pretty clearly that, you know, the assumptions here are based on literature and what we know, but we can't have a sort of really strong confidence in the point estimate that the model spits out.
What about sectoral effects in this? I mean, one area that interests me particularly is the City of London. I mean, there is a suggestion that although the hit has not been as fast as a lot of people anticipated, nevertheless, the shift in activity, the shift in highly skilled employment from London to other centres, not just in the EU, also in the Middle East and in North America. But this is something which is beginning to gather pace, and that is clearly a Brexit effect, but would seem to be anecdotally only in the early stages of something which could be actually quite serious. And another sector which has become very much in the news is the British defence sector, and there again, the detachment, the relatively unattractive arrangements that we had for access to the what is now underway as a very substantial European EU rearmament program and its funding. That is also a Brexit effect. People on the continent have been saying that one reason for our partial exclusion has been doubts about our future position, particularly what might happen politically in the next general election. And that has made continental armaments firms reluctant to get into long-term contracts with British counterparts. And again, that would seem to be a very significant Brexit effect over time for what is another strategic industry for the UK. Is there any way in which one can pick this up, or is this something which is it's too early to be able to judge, or can only be done by very specific sectoral analysis?
I think on finance we can see some impact. I mean, it's been quite interesting, the debate, because if you remember, before the UK left the single market, there were some reports that were saying, you know, we're going to lose tens of thousands of jobs, it doesn't appear to be have been quite as bad as that, at least in terms of employment. But you can really see some of the impact on exports, again, by comparing the UK to other advanced economies. Financial services exports have been on a bit of a tear, at least in nominal terms, with the recovery from the pandemic. And so other countries' exports on average have been growing pretty rapidly, whereas the UK's have been much more stagnant. That stagnation set in around 2019, which is as it became entirely clear that the UK was going to leave the single market with the failure of the second referendum push, and the ascension of Boris Johnson. So you can certainly see that kind of relative decline in financial services exports start in 2019. And I've tracked it, I think, through to mid 2024. And the relative decline has been continuing. So you're right that it may well be that that continues. The one question I have about that, I suppose, is just that the EU hasn't really decided, or policy hasn't been set up to try and recreate a kind of London financial centre within the EU itself. Activity has tended to divide between various other financial centres. One thing that we know about finance is that there are huge clustering effects. And so, if you can have lots of banks and skilled workers in finance all clustered together in space, then you end up with some pretty big benefits. So there are some just advantages that London has. And not all of its activity, in fact, a minority of its activity was geared towards the EU. It's always been a global financial sector, as you know, John. So there are other things pushing the other way, but we can certainly see that there has been relative decline, and that at least in up to the last date that I checked, it's been continuing. On defence. I'm much less of an expert on defence, the defence industry, than I should be, really. I guess I would make a couple of points. One is that there has been agreement, as you know, in the new common understanding between the UK and the EU, the framework for further negotiations, that the UK will be able to participate in SURE, as it's called, the EU's program whereby it borrows collectively to fund defence. So, on the margin, and of course the UK is going to have to make a financial contribution to that collective effort, but on the margin at least, some of the worst aspects of moving outside the EU's defence union have been sawn off. The other point to make is just about fiscal capacity. And Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, is borrowing over £100 billion to fund investment. And quite a large amount of that is going to defence, maybe about 60 billion from memory. But if we look at that compared to the huge package which is forthcoming in Germany, the very rapid rise in rearmament in Scandinavia, the Baltics, Poland, then the UK's kind of position as historically having been one of the sort of the two big powers in Europe looks like it's going to be eclipsed. And of course, that some of that fiscal constraint is down to Brexit. I mean, if you're looking at a 4 or 5% hit to GDP, that has a big impact on your tax revenues, and also therefore on your borrowing costs. And raising taxes has proved to be very difficult. So if I were to think about the main channel through which Brexit might impact defence, is probably more through the fiscal side than the trade side, but I might well be wrong about that, not being an expert.
Can I ask a question which you invited, I think, in what you said at the beginning, which is COVID and the energy crisis? How far do those two, as it were, enormous rocks thrown into the economic pond of the United Kingdom, how far do they invalidate even, or certainly make more speculative your general calculations, even with sophisticated methodology that you've given us?
Well, I mean, it's an excellent question. I think gets to the real heart of some of the issues with some of the backward-looking methods that I and others have used here. Because obviously, if you're comparing a country to a group of other countries at one point in time, then something might happen to either the country of interest here, Britain, or the other countries that is idiosyncratic. And so, your assumption that growth paths were the same between 2009 and 2016, so they're likely to be the same later, could get thrown off. The way that I've been thinking about it is that COVID is less of a problem than the energy crisis. And the reason for that is that COVID was a kind of general shock that hit everyone fairly equally. Countries did better or worse at managing it. Broadly speaking, the countries who most closely follow the UK's growth path, apart from Australia, managed it in relatively similar ways. And the UK, despite its not brilliant performance in the pandemic, and was about middle of the pack on excess deaths. So, in that sense, I'm like, well, does this really make that much difference? And the other point to make about COVID is that recovery was very rapid. It was a short, sharp shock down to lockdowns. Most countries protected incomes, either corporate income or household income, in order to stop the economy from fracturing into pieces. And so the recovery was relatively rapid. So I'm, obviously there are some assumptions there which are challengeable. But I think broadly, because it's this kind of general shock which affects everybody fairly equally, then it shouldn't throw things off too much. On the gas crisis, that, I stopped doing the model when the gas crisis hit, because that is a very European shock. Europe is a net energy importer. Putin invading Ukraine, and then and before that, cutting off the gas, and then Europe's attempts to get off Russian gas is a regional shock. And the countries that I compare the UK to are not just European ones. They're advanced economies across the globe. So, if I were to carry it on, then the cost of Brexit, as the model spits out, will probably be biased upwards in the sense that the cost would be bigger, simply because the UK is in Europe. Europe has an idiosyncratic shock. And those countries that are outside Europe but are in the comparator doppelganger don't suffer that shock as much, which would bias the costs upwards.
Final question. Well, John, do you have a final question? I have a final question for the other John, but
Well, I've got a couple, I'm afraid.
have a couple.
Carry on.
I mean, the first one is just to focus on this fiscal question, because one thing which has struck me very much is what has been going on in government bond yields and the fact that we have currently a very strange situation in which Greece, for example, is borrowing nearly 120 basis points cheaper in 10 years than the UK. And the UK is a standout, actually, compared to Eurozone countries, particularly. And I'm just wondering whether this is a Brexit effect.
I think there's some of it absolutely is a Brexit effect. So, if we take the OBR's average 4%, then obviously that means also a 4%, give or take, hit to tax revenues as well. And that's quite a lot. And if we look at the 2019 to 2024 Parliament, in which Rishi Sunak raised taxes quite significantly, over that Parliament, the tax take went up by about 100 billion. And if we take the OBR's 4%, then the hit to tax revenues was about 40 billion. So a significant amount of that rise in tax was down to Brexit. If Brexit hadn't happened and that 40 billion of tax revenues were more available, then the UK government's fiscal position would be a fair bit stronger. It would still have some difficulties owing to aging population and so forth. The other point is about growth. And John, if your hunch is right that there are further impacts on growth to come from Brexit, then there are questions about future tax revenues as well, which investors will be taking into account now. When they're thinking about what sort of price they're willing to pay for UK gilts. There's obviously many things which have made the UK's fiscal position so weak. The gas crisis is one of them. To a certain extent, Truss's failed experiment. But Brexit is certainly a part of it.
Thank you very much indeed, John. That was very, very interesting and illuminating. And I'm sure the debate will continue further.
Thanks very much for having me.